Welcome back to the Roundtable on WAMC. 13 minutes after 9 o'clock on Friday morning. It's the Roundtable panel, and joining us today, it's WAMC's Alan Shartok. Good morning, sir.
I'm proud to be here. Thank you, Ray.
I'm proud to have you here. Former EPA Regional Administrator Judith Enck is here today.
Good morning.
Nice to have you here as well. Associate Editor of the Times Union, Mike Spain.
Good morning.
Nice to have you here as well. And, oh, counterterrorism expert, Mr. Bond, Malcolm Nance is here. Nice to have you here.
Good morning.
The email address here as we get into the discussion is panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. You can write in with your deep thoughts, but keep them brief and try not to include links. Don't use abbreviations. Cogent, pithy, very quick. And we'll get to as many of the letters as we can. It's panel@wamc.org. U.S. consulate staff in St. Petersburg, Russia's second largest city, are preparing today to wind up operations after the Russian government ordered the consulate's closure. Russia announced the expulsion of more than 150 diplomats, including 60 Americans, on Thursday, said it was closing the U.S. consulate in retaliation for the wave of Western expulsions of Russian diplomats over the poisoning of an ex-spy and his daughter in Britain. And news now that the daughter is in stable condition and improving rapidly, has regained consciousness. The U.S. ambassador to Russia, John Huntsman, said there's no justification for throwing all the Americans out. It shows Moscow isn't interested at all in a dialogue with the U.S. about important matters. It's like the good old days, the 70s, the 60s, the Cold War. Doesn't it bring you back, Malcolm Nance?
Yeah, I sort of like the good old day analogy. Perhaps it's time that we do a complete reset with Russia. They've pretty much made it clear that they are now rich, relatively rich. They're actually a poor country. They've got the GDP of Italy and the gross monthly income of an average person in India. It's sort of a trailer park with atomic bombs. And I know,
nicely said.
I mean, so that being said, the Russian closing of the consulate in St. Petersburg doesn't hurt us. It hurts the people of Russia who have U.S. visas or want to visit the United States. That'll be no great loss on our part. The big question is how much tit for tat is going to keep going on. Russia knew all of this would happen. They probably assumed, and rightly so, that the Trump White House would pull those punches as well. Some things happen in our government on autopilot, like some of the sanctions that have gone on that were slipped into the budget. But for the most part, you've seen over the last, I think the reporting in the last 2 days is the president essentially made it clear to the White House staff that Russia policy we will not criticize Russia and our Russia policy.
I was going to say, we haven't heard a thing from Trump himself. We've heard from the surrogates, but certainly not from Trump.
And you never will?
Yeah. Because they have him by the hair.
Careful. Okay.
Whatever they have him on, it's good. I mean, this guy is literally like, you know, a drug runner that lost the load and has to report to the Colombian drug lords. And every day that he is in existence, he is elated. He does not criticize Russia ever.
How many novels do you think is being written about this right now?
In addition to my books, I'm sure dozens.
Yeah.
But this one isn't a fiction, is it?
But
the Russians have been vocal in criticizing the U.S. and the U.K. They've been a little lighter on the European allies. They haven't really pounded on them, at least verbally, with the rhetoric. Are they criticizing the president himself or just the U.S.? And
interesting. In 2010, Russia took this shift to where the United States was put back on the exact same level that it was in as an enemy and as an opponent as under the Soviet Union in the Cold War. There's some really fine scholarship out there. All you have to do is Russia View of the U.S. Rand Corporation, a couple of other entities have done these reports about the massive Russian Federation propaganda campaign against the United States, which is part of their effort to take us down as a superpower. And when I say take us down, they want to economically disable us. And they did a pretty good job by getting Trump in power. But for the most part, the rhetoric that goes out on Russia Today, Channel One, all of these Russian propaganda channels, is how they are powerful. We are weak warmongers. And you see things like this ballistic missile test that they did, which helps strengthen that opinion. a lot of what we see is really internal consumption propaganda in the old Soviet manner, you know, like with Pravda, you know, is now today you can see it out on open internet.
Kind of like Fox News.
No, better. A little more accurate.
Let me ask you, Malcolm Nance, how important is the actual ex-spy and his daughter? Lavrov eagerly want to speak with the daughter who has now regained consciousness. How important is that factor?
Wait, Lavrov wants to speak? The Russian foreign minister wants to speak?
Well, I mean, he says Russia wants to speak with.
Sure he does.
Okay, but they want to help.
My point is this spy was exchanged in 2010.
Yeah.
Clearly everything, you would expect everything that is known is already known. Why would this person be targeted at this
time? I can only
time?
Tell you what I've heard in open source information, which is this guy was like crown jewels intelligence. He was a GRU officer, Russian military intelligence. He was a colonel. He knew the real names of agents that were being handled. If I'm not mistaken, some crazy figure, like 250 actual known agents, and quite possibly, you know, who were Americans and other people around Europe. And the British were handling him, brought him out. And they say he may be the second or third most significant spy in the history of the Cold War.
My point is that was years ago. He was swapped in 2010.
Right, he was captured by the Russians.
Why kill him now, or try to kill him now?
Well, what's going on is a smirch campaign, a death to spies campaign.
Sure, where make an example.
Yeah, well, Vladimir Putin, ex-KGB officer, former director of Russian intelligence, and, you know, he has a long... He actually said this himself on television about 2 months ago. The only thing he will not tolerate is betrayal of the country. And he has sent people out using oligarchs or using other surrogates, and they are killing people that worked for us, worked in our defense, who we owe a right to their survival. And Putin is throwing it in our face by going out and executing these people around the world. This could just as easily have happened in the United States using a weapon of mass destruction, right, which injured over 21 people. If ISIS had done that, we would be invading Iraq again.
Yeah.
The Russians, of course, say, well, this is, and I'm quoting the Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman yesterday, it's a swindle and an international provocation, and they dismiss the claims that Russia was behind this. Russia was behind this, yeah?
Yeah, Russia was behind this weapon system. I mean, let's talk about the weapons that Russia has been using for assassination. It's almost like they had this arsenal during the Cold War, and because the Cold War was, you know, sort of hot between intelligence agencies, they couldn't use them. So they decided, hey, the Cold War's over. We've got some guys we need to whack. Let's go get, I don't know, polonium-210, a nuclear isotope, which is extremely rare. We can track the actual reactor that it comes from, which was in Russia. They poisoned one guy by putting that in his tea. Another person, you know, there's a whole series.
Was stabbed with the umbrella on the bridge.
Well, that was ricin, and that was done by Bulgarian intelligence.
Right.
We now have guys trying to kill their
right?
wives
Same
using
thing.
That. But this latest one, Novichok, is 8 times more powerful than VX nerve gas, which is the baseline standard nerve gas.
If you are an intelligence agency, what kind of tradecraft would allow you to use something that is so easily traceable back to you unless you're sending a message?
Well, that's flipping a bird tradecraft. I mean, the Russians are telling us, screw you guys. We now feel, because of the environment, and I'm sorry to say it, by electing Trump, they feel empowered that they can now run. They are running a hot war amongst global intelligence and our past spies. And if I were president, this war would get even hotter because what happens next? They start killing our agents or our subcontractors? This thing's going to get out of control, and Putin doesn't care.
You know, Malcolm, you keep saying they elected Trump. Did they?
Yeah, of course they did. Anybody, I can't wait to see the responses on there, but the amount of information we're learning now about the influence campaign. This campaign started in 2012. We now know that. There's a thing called the Rykov Confession of a guy who, the night after Mitt Romney won the campaign, Donald Trump tweeted that people should be marching on the U.S., on the White House. A guy by the name of Konstantin Rykov, he's the Ted Turner of Russia, wrote a Facebook post saying that he wrote a direct message back to Trump to DM Trump. That means these two had to be in communication with each other. And he said, what can Russia do to help? Trump sends him back a thumbs up picture. And then Trump communicates to him over the years that they were using Cambridge Analytica. All of this is in my book. There's actually an article in Washington Monthly from last year called The Confession in Plain Sight. And Russia had been coordinating all of this stuff. And we know the Internet Research Agency started in 2013. Every bit of this was done to get Donald Trump made president, and they did.
Wow.
Other than that,
well done, Malcolm.
There's no other information.
You've done something we haven't been able to do in 3 years. You silenced the panel. Good for you. You know, one of the things that hearkened for me back to this Cold War bit was a tense headline this morning. Could enemies sabotage undersea cables linking the world? Russian ships are skulking around underwater communications cable, causing the U.S. and its allies to worry the Kremlin might be taking information warfare to new depths. This is absolutely nothing new. Yeah, this
yeah,
is...
I am a submarine-qualified spy, so which means I carried out what were called submarine special operations. That's all I'm going to say about that.
Okay.
fair enough. And things happen, things get tapped, I don't know, but Russia has a new capability. They have some new submarine systems. Many countries do this.
I mean, all these cables now are ostensibly privately owned. Google and the like. Should they be concerned?
They should be concerned because it's not just a question of being able to tap the information data flow. It's almost easier to get it from when it comes up on air. But the fiber optics are so hard to get that sometimes you want to go and you know, put a special link down there. The worst part is when you blow them up or send down remote vehicles and cut them in half.
But wouldn't that be counterproductive for the enemy side as well?
In war, it wouldn't.
Well, okay. Our email address here is panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. A few minutes before our BBC break, and Mike Spain, what's new on the New York State budget?
Thank God.
Well, the budget, the annual deadline under law to adopt a state budget is April 1st, and that's fast upon us. The Assembly and the Senate were meeting late into the night, and the Senate is said to be meeting again this morning to kind of come up with what they will okay in a spending plan for the upcoming fiscal year, and then get out of town for the holy days, the Passover and the Easter holy days, and then the state assembly they want to be able to come back into town on Monday and maybe do their part, which would still meet the budget deadline. But the issue here, Ray, is when the governor, under New York law, after a court ruling when Governor Pataki was in power versus Sheldon Silver, who at the time ran the state assembly, he has the authority in his budget package to put all kinds of policy and all kinds of bills and load it up with things that would achieve changes in the way government operates, basically that would guarantee rights to victims of sexual abuse to sue their the entity that they believe is responsible, or school funding measures, lots of other controversial issues, maybe some campaign finance reform, et cetera. A lot of that now is still in the budget, but it's being taken out in the final moments in order to get a spending plan full. And then that means that thereafter, the governor doesn't have the leverage anymore to make this go through. So a lot of things like pay raises for the legislators.
Will they happen this time, Alan?
Well, I have to say I'm very disappointed. I think they might happen. The governor has said the one thing that has to happen is that the budget has to be on time.
But that's April 16th, yeah?
No, April 1st.
April 1st?
You're thinking of tax day.
Ah, I thought the fiscal year began. What is the fiscal
April 1st.
April 1st?
Yeah.
Okay.
So last time his demand was, and they were furious at him that he didn't keep his word, was that he would trade no outside income, which is the way these characters make their money. I mean, as I have said before, you get up and you say I have to hire a lawyer. Shall I hire a lawyer who's a senator, or shall I hire just a goofus? So you hire the senator, of course, because he has or she has more influence. And that's what this is all about. This is how they make out. And they didn't take that deal. They were so angry about it.
Yeah, limits on outside income would clean up state government considerably by removing all kinds of conflicts and neo-conflicts of interest. But in order to get their pay raise, that's what they'd have to give up. And as you say, they've been reluctant to do it.
In the past. Yeah. Now, this time, he's not making that demand. You see? This time, he's only saying, have it done on time. In the meantime, they've got a guy who, one of the senators, who is saying, unless you let Orthodox schools off the state education demands of what you do, right, Mike?
Simca Felder.
He's Senator Plastic Bag from Brooklyn.
Right, from Brooklyn. He is a Democrat, but he sits with the Republican caucus and helps them keep control of the Senate. And he is backing a bill that would keep state education policy from being enforced in yeshiva schools that are predominantly or completely Orthodox Jewish populations around the state. They don't want to have the same standards imposed on them for math and science, and teachers and educators are saying you can't have that two-tiered system, and that's really slowing things down.
Well, Judith. As my boy Jonas would say, that ain't right.
I think the bigger problem is, and I've had the luxury of being away from Albany when I served in the Obama administration, and I'm kind of fresh on this, and you know, it is a terrible way to make decisions. The state budget is the most important bill that they adopt in every state legislature. And they do it at the 11th hour in the middle of the night, literally. Elected members of the legislature don't read the bills. There's no chance of them to read it. And not only is there an increase in injecting policy issues, but really bad things pop up in the middle of the night. Last night, I learned of a really horrible environmental provision that has snuck into the budget.
What is it? We only have about 10 seconds, but go ahead.
I'll tell you when we come back.
On the other side of the news? Judith Enck is here. Malcolm Nance, Alan Shartok, and Mike Spain. You as well at panel@wamc.org. We'll get to Judith's next point and some mail coming up. Welcome back to the Roundtable on WAMC. A happy Friday morning to you, 9:33, and it's the Roundtable panel. We have with us today Malcolm Nance, Mike Spain, Alan Shartok, and Judith Enck. And Judith, you were in the middle of an idea when we went to break, so back to you.
So I was just pointing out that we're all used to this in the Capital District, but doing the budget in the middle of the night when no one knows the details is really problematic, and we shouldn't just kind of accept it as the way it's always been. And it is getting worse in that, as was mentioned, policy issues that have absolutely nothing to do with the budget appear in the middle of the night and become law. And a recent example is I pay a lot of attention to the issue of plastic in the ocean. Estimates are that within the next few years, for every 3 pounds of fish in the ocean, there will be 1 pound of plastic.
Whoa.
And it's devastating.
I heard it's the size of Texas, the biggest
garbage patches.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a sleeper issue, but people who are concerned about marine biology and is that plastic getting in the fish we eat, et cetera, really pay attention to this. So California has been doing some really progressive policies. What we get in New York is last year, Governor Cuomo and the aforementioned Senator Simca Felder passed a bill that blocked New York City from putting a fee on plastic bags to discourage the use of plastic bags. And that's a lot of bags in New York City, where 8 million people live.
They say tons every couple of weeks.
But as a practical matter, if you were trying to discourage plastic bags, don't you just ban plastic bags?
As we did in Great Barrington.
That is one approach.
There are different approaches.
Some are bans. A lot of the data actually says that modest fees work better than bans. I'm fine with either. New York City took 4 years to put it on the books, and the New York State Legislature wiped it out just for New York City.
Not for Suffolk County.
It's the de Blasio-Cuomo fight. So they did that last year. This year, what we're being treated to is New York's original bottle bill, the first bill I worked on as a college student, banned those six ring plastic containers that hold,
for the six packs.
Yeah, hold six packs
sure.
together. So a bill passed the Senate a few days ago that allows for really heavy plastic containers to be used on beverages. So it seems minor, but you've probably seen it. It's on craft beers. They're
right.
colorful. They're hard plastic. They're supposed to be easy to
hold
recycle.
The cans all together.
Right.
Yeah.
But recycling's not the issue. It's a lot of that plastic winds up as litter and in the ocean. So nothing to do with the budget. The Senate passed the bill a few days ago in the light of day, and the governor was pushing it, and now the assembly is going along. So unless I don't know which pieces of the budget passed last night, this may be already done, or this assembly may be poised to do this. This is going to result in a lot more plastic pollution in our environment, and that was inserted into the state budget with no one knowing.
I have a question for you guys. Who gave Cuomo $31 million to run for governor with?
Well,
Of them might be plastic lobbyists.
The company that makes that plastic product did give a significant amount of money to the governor.
Yeah, John DeFrancesco, who was the GOP Senate Deputy Majority Leader, said yesterday, nobody knows until everything is done. And that's exactly what's going on. They rush it through the last night or the last days before the budget has to be approved. And the governor issues an emergency order so the bills do not have to sit for 3 days.
Yes,
so people can actually maybe possibly read them. And people like Judith can look at them and point out the flaws in them. Instead, they waive that. It gets rammed through as an emergency bill, and we'll have a budget on April 1st probably. A lot of things won't be in it that we wanted in it, and a lot of things that people wanted don't want in it will be in it, and we'll find out about it next week, and then the legislature will come back until June and hash out the rest and probably not get a whole lot more.
So now these are people who work generally a day or two a week, right? I mean, they claim they're back in the district.
Yeah, I'm sure they're doing work in the district.
Doing very hard.
Some do.
But what's so interesting to me, and always has been as I've watched these characters, is that now they want to get back to be with their constituents and their families for Passover and for Easter. So you mean to say that even though we elect them to watch the budget and to do the budget, it becomes more important to get home than to watch what's in the budget.
And they know that the deadline is April 1st every year. So they can
April Fool's Day, isn't it?
Yeah, they can start a little earlier, but it's three men in a room, and it's dysfunctional. It's not the way a democracy is supposed to work, and it's getting worse every year.
It's actually four men in a room, just to keep it right.
Yes.
Because now you've
got
the
Jeff
traitors, the Democrats who have gone for a few pieces of gold to be with the Republicans.
So are there cigars and whiskey?
Sure.
Well, there used to be. They've cleaned it up a little bit.
Smoke-filled room? All right.
The history of this is there were years back in the 80s when the budget didn't get passed until August.
Yeah. Right. Mm.
So when Andrew Cuomo came in, he said, I'm going to get a budget on time, and he's been able to get a budget on time or within a day
time-ish.
Or two. On time-ish, right. And he's claiming that, and that's very important to him politically if he wants to look like a fiscally sound governor, if he has greater ambition.
But in a state the size of New York, we should be able to have an on-time budget that is not done in the middle of the night with sleazy back deals injected into budget language that has nothing to do with state spending. We're New York, you know, we're a big state. We're a large economy. You know, businesses wouldn't get away with budget making the way the state legislature does.
I have a little bit of a problem with what you just said. I just want to turn it around and say, yes, we're New York.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, that's the way they do it.
That's how you should expect it to be. Now, historically, that's the way it's been done, and I don't understand why it can't change.
Well, because the status quo just lets this get worse, and perhaps we need new leadership in the governor's office, in the legislature, to make things different.
Judith Enck is with us today, also Alan Shartok, Malcolm Nance, and Mike Spain. You also are with us via email at panel@wamc.org. We'll take a quick break, and then we have a whole stack of letters to read, and we'll do that coming up. Sonny Rollins for you on the roundtable. It is 9:42 on a Friday morning. Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue. By the way,
You know, Sonny lives in the region.
He does, listens.
If you ever wanted to do a Vox Pop and take some calls,
we know
I'm down with it. You know what I mean?
He's terrific.
Our email here is panel@wamc.org. And, Alan, we have some letters.
We do. Mary writes, how is it that elected officials are making late-night decisions on policy that they don't even, quote, have a chance to read? And that's Mary. Well, Mary, it isn't their highest priority. Their highest priority is not getting it right. Look, here's what happens. We have 210, 211 people in the state legislature between the two houses. You would think that each of them would be making a positive contribution, but they're not. They're choosing leaders, and those leaders go in, and without consulting with them, by the way, because they can't, they can prior consult, but not while they're doing it, they give away the store, and they have this thing. So why have 211? Why not just have three?
And or as you mentioned, four. It's Jeff just Klein, four men behind closed doors. They don't give daily reports to the press on what they're doing. And I would argue it is getting worse every year.
And Barb in Colony, good morning, panel. Please, Malcolm, find another analogy for Russia other than a trailer park. Those of us who live in or know loved ones in trailer parks are insulted by that analogy.
Okay, I'm sorry.
It's a good point.
Nancy
okay, I'll look for one.
I'm
okay,
sorry.
Good. You're going to sing, I'm sorry?
Nancy says, Malcolm.
Yes.
I love it when Malcolm is on and always feel reassured that we have people like him in our intelligence agencies. I always wonder, however, if he worries about his own life. I've asked you this question because he has been so vocal and influential in educating us about Russia and their tactics on both WAMC and MSNBC. I worry for his safety. Nancy from West Sand Lake.
Well, a year ago, I had an incident where some information came out in the Washington Times, the Washington Examiner, and Breitbart that essentially called me a member of ISIS. I mean, it was weird, you know, saying I told ISIS how to do an attack. And it was bizarre since I spent 30-some-odd years in counterterrorism intelligence. And I received over 50 death threats in 24
hours. No.
That
beats anything I've
seen. Yeah, and I mean really direct ones against wife, children. They went to my mother's house in South Carolina and photographed it and put it all up in the comment section of Breitbart. I have a famous incident on Bill Maher last year where I confronted the editor-in-chief of Breitbart asking him, are they going to apologize? Never did, you know. So, no, I don't fear for my life because, one, I'm a bored ex-sniper. And, you know, I got a fence that's 10 feet in from my property line. So once you cross that fence, no, but no.
Just saying.
Concealed carry license.
And Robert says, Russia or UK? Even if Britain did this as a false flag op versus Russia, it was brilliant. Who's going to believe the Russians? And it's signed North Country Bumpkin.
Because you'd I'm glad they admit that they're a bumpkin, because you'd have to be a bumpkin to believe that Alex Jones and the right wing and Russia Today have been saying Britain took samples of their super secret chemical weapon and then sprayed it on these Russian agents that Britain needed to cover it, to accuse Russia of bad things. It's the same crazy talk about saying that the FBI decided to destroy Hillary Clinton so that they could frame Trump to blame Russia about something. I don't know. Cookie talk.
Bobby says, can Malcolm explain Cambridge Analytica?
Yeah.
Could you please have Malcolm explain how personal information can be weaponized and why Cambridge Analytica is such a nefarious entity?
Okay, I'll do this in 30 seconds. Okay, Cambridge Analytica is an organization that was put together by Steve Bannon and funded by the Mercer family, the super conservative Mercer family. Their job was to weaponize information by taking information from Facebook, other sources, stripping that data down, analyzing what you look at, what you like, what you don't like, and they can go very deep in there. Then they could take political propaganda and focus it specifically to you in order to evoke a negative emotion. And they were doing that with Hillary Clinton ads. The problem is that Russian intelligence may have been their biggest source of propaganda. And that we think that there's a bridge between Russian government propaganda that was either handed off by Cambridge or or slungshot by Cambridge into your mind.
Now, while we're on the subject, sorry, Ray, I know that you're the chief of the program.
Oh, gosh, no.
While we're on the subject, early morning watching around 3 a.m. or 4 a.m. of the cable channels indicated that Mueller was getting closer to proving the Russian connection. It's pretty interesting stuff.
Yeah, I'm sure Mueller
with
is.
Gates.
Mueller has to put together an airtight case that these people were knowingly working with a foreign intelligence agency. Now we think he has reams more information than we're ever going to know until that final report comes out. Well, he's got that case. That case is easy.
Well, 2 days ago, there was a legal filing where
Mueller
confirmed that Gates was working closely with Russian operatives during the campaign.
Right, Konstantin Klimnik, who was in the meeting with Donald Trump Jr. with the "I love it" email.
Mm-hmm.
He was the guy they called a lobbyist in Washington D.C. Everybody knew he worked for the GRU, but only U.S. intelligence know that he was still working for the GRU, Russian intelligence.
Let's see, says Mike. Rex Tillerson, H.R. McMaster, and now VA Secretary David Shulkin, all fired via Twitter. Apparently, they're all forewarned by Chief of Staff John Kelly. Most bosses I know will fire a person face-to-face. I always thought that was the honorable thing to do. I don't think Donald Trump has the courage to fire somebody face-to-face except on The Apprentice. Trump promised to, quote, hire the best. Looking at the number of people he's fired since he took office, that doesn't seem to be going so well. And that's from Mike from Glen Falls.
Well, it's a record number.
Glen Falls.
That's been fired or left. But I think the way the VA secretary was fired yesterday was interesting. And I give him a lot of credit for not doing a Tillerson and just running home and not speaking about how shabbily they were treated. He wrote an op-ed. He's been doing interviews.
He was on Morning Joe this morning talking about how shabbily he's been treated.
He did an interview yesterday that Trump actually called him the day he was fired and just had like a chit-chat about veterans' issues.
Yeah.
And I'm sure Kelly told Trump, you can't fire by Twitter anymore. It's just really unbecoming of a president. And then Trump couldn't pull the trigger on the phone call, hangs up, and then later that day tells Kelly to call him to tell him he's fired, and then Trump tweeted.
But that raises the question, because there's been numerous reports in the last few weeks about how Kelly's own status is in question and that he possibly himself may be on the way out. How will Trump ever fire him? Ooh, he doesn't have Kelly to turn to do it.
Probably by tweet. I mean, remember how Comey was fired.
Yeah, that's right. He saw it on CNN when he was speaking in L.A. Yeah.
Very cowardly, the way he humiliates his own handpicked cabinet.
It's a sociopathic behavior. I mean, he won't look you in the eye before he does something nefarious. I feel very sorry for anyone associated with this administration. I know someone who was in counterterrorism who recently left the White House. And, you know, in our community, we felt sympathy for this guy because he's like literally a legend in the community. But everyone else is not getting jobs. They're done. Their careers forever are going to be marred by this.
Well,
certainly when the future findings come out.
Well, I call BS on them, and I'll tell you I'll tell you why. I don't feel any sympathy for them. these are people who knew they were getting in bed with a viper, or as the old joke goes, you knew what I was when you took me in.
Some people took the job right after Trump came in, hoping that they could help steer the course and prevent him from going off, and keep him on course and do some good government service in spite of him because they believe in the greater good.
I was asked by Jack Kingston to come in and brief Trump because he had supposedly read my 544-page book, Defeating ISIS.
Well, that's a lie right there.
And he told Time Magazine that. What's the last book you read? Defeating ISIS. And I was like, okay. A lot of pictures. But I was asked to come in to the campaign, you know, potentially prospective for the administration. I said, no, I like my wife. You know, there's no way I would ever join an administration that is knowingly this dirty.
I am so sorry, Malcolm. I'm sitting on the other side of the room from you, and my ears are not what they once were. Did you say, I like my life?
My wife. Like my wife said if I were to do it, she'd divorce me.
Smart woman.
And I like her.
That's great. Hi, panel. Is it possible than any of the 60 Russian diplomats who were expelled were people who might have been called to testify against Trump, or am I fantasizing a spy movie kind of stuff?
No, that's too deep.
Yeah, no. I agree with you.
I did ask Malcolm when we were off mic about how many of those 60 Russian diplomats that were expelled were actually spies.
All of them. All intelligence
collectors. And how many of ours are spies?
Zero.
Really?
Very few, because, for example, last year you might recall the Russians asked the United States government to downsize 755 positions in Russia. Those weren't U.S. diplomats. Those were all of our the local Russian staff who fill out visas, do processing and everything. And Trump made a joke about it, saying, good, you saved me, you know, the opportunity from firing all of those people. We don't use that many human intelligence and signals intelligence guys in our embassies the way the Russians do. The U.S. the Russian embassy in Washington, D.C. is suspected of having at least 100 additional spies working in there right now who were not kicked out.
Keith writes, after a couple of weeks, the Austin police chief is finally, in capitals, finally referring to the white Austin bomber as a terrorist.
Yeah.
What is the law enforcement accepted definition of terrorist, and should it be changed to reflect and improve our political climate? More importantly, is the media using the word terrorist correctly? I feel that many in the media and the president use the word terrorist and Muslim interchangeably, but we have a completely different standard when it comes to Caucasians who commit violence against citizens for their political views.
We haven't gotten a very clear read whether that kid was actually doing it for politics yet. And I'm carefully watching that. I was one of the first people in the media to say that by the second bomb, I called it a terrorist bombing campaign. There was just two diverse delivery systems, two diverse targets in a circular area. That was going to be a bombing campaign.
So let me get this straight from all of you. Is the word terrorist tied to either Muslims, or is it tied to those who would do damage? I mean, what is a terrorist?
Anyone who attempts to inflict terror in a community on a large scale. I don't think it's like a one-time thing. It's when
the legal definition is terrorism is an act of violence or threat of violence in which intended to influence an audience outside of the immediate victims.
That's exactly right. It's to I think both of you agree.
Political
it's
violence.
To spread terror. It's right. It's an act against an individual or a group, but it makes a whole lot more people very frightened and can affect their activity,
which is what happened in Austin.
It requires a political ideological basis, and we need to find out what that is.
Yeah, this
kid
just might have been mentally ill and angry at people. And
but he still may have wanted to inspire terror, right, Mike?
Well, we don't know what his intentions were, but he's dead, and it's very difficult to tell. But I think what you're saying, clarify this, is if he had a political point of view and he was doing this to incite terror, that's one thing. If he was mentally ill and he just wanted to kill people because he was really angry and had some mental deficit and he didn't plan to incite terror, he didn't have a political point of view against the government or politics or something like that, technically he wouldn't be a terrorist. He'd be a mentally ill killer.
A bomber.
It's often both.
I mean,
if you really, you have to have a certain degree of mental illness to kill large numbers of people.
A lot of guys who do bombings against their ex-wives, which, by the way, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, most explosives that are used in the United States are used against other individuals, aren't terrorism. They're attempted murder through explosive system. You know, but if you go out, like the Unabomber had a manifesto that he wanted spread out there, an ideology, that's what made him a terrorist.
I know.
About the Las Vegas killer? Do we really know?
No one knows.
And why is that so quiet all this time later?
That may be my PhD thesis, because I tell you, that one and the Pulse nightclub shooting, the Pulse nightclub shooting, I can't quite. I've been studying it for 2 years, still can't figure out whether it was an act of terrorism masquerading, an act of internal personal drama masquerading as terrorism.
We haven't learned a lot about the Vegas thing. I mean,
no, that zip black hole. Don't.
Times did a piece last week that was sort of a TikTok, you know.
And there were pictures of him at the hotel, you know, with he was going through kind of a typical quiet day, having dinner, having luggage filled with ammunition coming up to his room. It was very
everything
odd.
In a casino is photographed all the time.
Yeah.
There should be lots of evidence.
Well,
every year, every year you have the SHOT Show there. So thousands upon thousands of guns are humped up into hotel rooms. They wouldn't have thought anything different. The man just, his flip switched. I mean, switch flipped. Mm. And he wanted to be the largest mass murderer in U.S. history,
I suspect. Sadly, he pulled it off.
All right, one more maybe, Alan, and then we'll take a break.
Okay, Malcolm, what was Russia's motive getting DT elected?
Oh, I don't know. Chaos? I'm going to go with chaos. But also, more importantly, number one, to lift the sanctions. The sanctions which were levied against Russia, that's going after real money, personal oligarch billions. Mm-hmm. And they want that lifted. And they may get it. You never know.
Okay, here's an interesting one from Toby, entitled Plastic Bags in New York City. I am from New York City, and keep in mind it is difficult for city dwellers to carry enough reusable grocery bags because they cannot keep them in their cars. City folk are going to the store via subway and bus and on the way home from work or other errands. How many reusable bags can you carry in your purse or pocket all day? A fee will disproportionately hurt those in New York City versus the suburbs and rural areas of New York. I agree plastic is a problem, but a fee might not be the best answer in cities where few people drive. I can just say in our town of Great Barrington, no plastic bags.
15 seconds,
Judith. You could do a fee. You could do a ban. And I carry, this is bad for radio, but
you
I have
a little
pouch that turns into a bag that you can carry in your pocket.
Oh my God,
your
it's like QVC now. Oh. This is great.
And this is, I'm not going to say the brand. And I just bring these everywhere.
And look, it's of all colors.
Well, and
you just have to, change your habits. It is not
That's
hard.
That's exactly right.
All right, we'll take a quick break here. Our email address is panel@wamc.org. We have Malcolm Nance, Mike Spain, Judith Ank, and Alan Chartok, and you as well. We'll be back after news. Welcome back to the Roundtable on WAMC. It's 10:05 on a Friday morning. Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue. We have a panel today, and what a panel we have. Mike Spain from the Times Union is here. Former EPA Regional Administrator Judith Ank is here. Counterterrorism expert Malcolm Nance is here. General expert Alan Chartok is here.
You're too kind.
The email address is largely accurate, too. Panel@wamc.org is the email address. The Trump administration is set to loosen pollution and efficiency rules for new passenger cars and trucks. EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt expected to announce a plan to relax existing tailpipe standards that apply through 2025, scrapping the previous target of an average of 36 miles per gallon, which was set during the Obama administration. And Greg Dotson wrote an interesting piece on theconversation.com, and I'll quote a little here. Some segments of the auto industry understand the importance of emission standards. A recent survey done on behalf of Clean Transportation Industry Group found that 95% of auto parts suppliers agreed that more ambitious standards encourage innovation and investment in the U.S. These companies overwhelmingly want the EPA standards maintained or even strengthened, letting policymakers know that any relaxation will cost the U.S. manufacturing sector jobs.
Well, that's a generous interpretation by Greg Dotson, who I respect a lot. But it's basically the car companies went to President Trump in his first weeks in office and said, let us get out of an agreement we reached with President Obama to improve fuel efficiency standards. And what that is about is, when you go to buy a new or used car, you want to know what's the miles per gallon on gasoline. Who wants to waste money at the pump on spending more for gas? And so the whole trajectory of the auto industry in the United States is fuel efficiency gets better and better each year, mostly because of EPA regulations that require that you meet minimum standards. They're called the CAFE standards, corporate average fuel efficiency. So one of the most important things President Obama did environmentally was reach an agreement with the auto industry back in 2009. And remember, that was right after Obama bailed out the auto industry to the tune of $80 billion, which they've paid back, by the way. The president was criticized for that, but the companies paid it back. But I think they were in a good mood to cooperate on an important environmental issue. And they reached this important agreement that would cut oil consumption by 12 billion barrels and reduce carbon pollution by 6 billion tons over the lifetime of all of the cars affected by these regulations. So it's good for air quality. It's good to reduce carbon pollution that affects climate change. It's good for you and me, so we pay less at the pump. So the auto companies convinced President Trump to dramatically change these regulations. And next week, Scott Pruitt, the worst EPA administrator in the history of the agency, is supposed to go to a auto dealership in Virginia and announce that they're relaxing these standards.
An interesting governmental thing here is that Pruitt also expected to deny the state of California its ability to adopt tougher standards on tailpipe emissions. And as I understand it, those standards, and California has been setting them since before the EPA came into being in 1970.
Look, these guys are killers.
Yep.
I mean, I'm sorry to put it that way, but if your kid has autism...
Asthma.
I'm so sorry. That was a bad one. Asthma, the kid could die. So when Judith says, quite properly, you know, reads off the list of things like the standards and everything else, you really have to put it into real human terms to understand it.
Well, these requirements, they fight right to the last minute. Remember back in the 80s when they were starting to require that the automakers put in airbags? They said, we can't do it. It's impossible. The technology's not there yet. We're not going to be able to afford it. It'll raise the price of an automobile. It's going to put us out of business. It's going to really hurt us badly, badly, badly. They did it. And now thousands and thousands of lives have been saved because of it. And it's just standard right now. It's part of what you do.
Well, you know, when I got here this morning, I turned off this Prius that I own. And it told me that I had gotten 54 miles to the gallon coming over from Great Barrington. So let us not think it can't be done. It can.
And there's a bright future for electric cars, but this is a situation where EPA's Clean Air Act regulations is indeed technology forcing. And I know I'm harshly critical of Scott Pruitt. This is one of many things he and his partners in government have done to really promote the fossil fuel industry. And I think it's worse than anyone can imagine. There was a media report a few months ago that Scott Pruitt flew to Morocco first class, spending $40,000 in tax dollars. He brought his staff with him. He went to Morocco simply to promote liquid natural gas exports in Morocco. Why would an EPA administrator do that? He's not the energy or commerce secretary. We learned yesterday that the company that would benefit more than any from this policy of exporting liquefied natural gas is a company called Cheniere Energy. Pruitt, guess what, is living in the condo co-owned by the lobbyist for that company.
Are you suggesting a conflict of interest?
You can't make this stuff up. He was living in this luxury condo near Capitol Hill, co-owned by the company that will benefit from this new export.
You mean in Washington?
In Washington,
D.C.
Oh,
I see. I thought you meant that. Yeah.
And so it's just conflict after conflict. The whole notion that the VA secretary was hounded out because of bad travel decisions. If you let Scott Pruitt get away with this stuff, you know, where is the floor for ethical misbehavior in Washington?
He gets a free trip to Morocco, which is nice.
$40,000 in tax dollars. He brought his staff.
It's been a heck of a trip.
I'm glad we were cleaning up the swamp.
So long as he doesn't get on the cover of Time magazine, he will never lose his job.
Meanwhile, a federal judge has dismissed a lawsuit by ExxonMobil aimed at stopping an investigation by New York and Massachusetts officials into whether the oil giant misled investors and the public about its knowledge of climate change and how the issue could affect its business. A U.S. District Judge Valerie Caproni in New York said yesterday that Exxon's lawsuit was, quote, running roughshod over the adage that the best defense is a good offense. Exxon says it's reviewing the decision.
this is the best news of the week on climate change issues. I give a lot of credit to New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman and Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey. Over 2 years ago, they decided to investigate Exxon. Is it a securities investigation? First, they argued that Exxon knew about the negative impacts of climate change for decades and misled their own investors on the risks of climate change. And then secondly, Exxon funded climate denier organizations, which they continue to do today.
Sounds a lot like the cigarette companies.
It's the same pattern.
So Schneiderman and Healey wisely decided to do an investigation. Exxon punched back and said this investigation interfered with their First Amendment constitutional rights to free speech and challenged this in court. And thankfully, this
Judge Caproni, right?
Judge Caproni said,
a name we know from recent news.
Yes, mm-hmm. She said, no way. She said that actually this case runs roughshod over the adage that the best defense is a good offense. And she threw out this Exxon frivolous lawsuit. And the good news is Schneiderman and Healey can now not be pestered by this distraction and continue to investigate Exxon.
My guess is they're going to find another one.
Another judge?
Another diversion.
Oh, yeah. Exxon will keep fighting this, but it's a really important investigation,
was
as we know from tobacco.
They were concerned about their right to lie.
I guess.
To freely lie to the public, which we've felt is upheld speech.
Okay. I think that's a protected speech, isn't it? Lying?
Lying?
Yeah.
I guess.
Don't know.
We
to
have
the
emails.
Public.
What?
We have emails.
Oh, we do. Yes. Laura says, good morning. Thank you for the show. The BBC has an excellent piece during the night last night. The biodegradable plastic bags are as bad as petroleum-based mm-hmm. bags. They only degrade in specific physical conditions, including high heat. They do not degrade in the ocean or landfills. Banning petroleum plastic bags, as Northampton, Massachusetts has done, will not help the environment or the oceans. And that's from Dr. Laura. Mm.
Well, she's right, and it's kind of science fiction that you can have a biodegradable plastic bag. But think of it, if it does break down, it just breaks down into smaller pieces of plastic, which is a greater risk to the marine ecology because fish and seabirds eat the pieces of plastic. So
is she right, though, that my town of Great Barrington and Northampton shouldn't have this rule? I don't know that she says they shouldn't have it, but they say will not help the environment or the ocean.
Ban plastic bags altogether, I think, is the option.
I think banning them or putting a fee on them, and don't get into this whole notion of biodegradable bags are okay, because mm-hmm. they're not.
Interesting. Okay, and we've also heard from John in Highland. Just curious, how do we know that Malcolm is still not working for American intelligence? Wouldn't having a direct voice on cable news and radio media be a benefit to the covert propaganda machine? John from Ireland.
The covert propaganda machine? It doesn't have to be covert. No, John, I'm sorry. They don't pay me enough. Anything I do for free. But, you know, it's easier just to tell you the truth. Propaganda is pretty prevalent out there to where the truth is now starting to sound like propaganda to people who will not believe the truth. Quick little aside, I was at a rest area in on the thruway the other day, and the news was on about the New York Times article breaking, and there was a gentleman there sitting there, and when I said, wow, that's interesting, he goes, fake news. And I go, why? He goes, New York Times, fake news. And I said, I work for MSNBC. He goes, fake news. And, you know, it's just an example of how pervasive the cult-like reading of what the truth is anymore. Empirical truth is under attack, and we need to protect it.
That's a great insight. Malcolm, the investigation against Trump informed that POGS, were involved. Can Malcolm please explain what a POG is?
A pogue?
Oh, a pogue, yes.
Pogue? People other, that's a joke. Someone's trying to sass me here.
Is that right?
Yeah, okay. It's a marine thing. People other than grunts.
Okay, here we go.
I got you. Come on, man. I spend enough time around marines.
Anita says,
is
a campaign against people of color defined as terrorism, is racism a form of mental illness?
What?
Well, okay, again, I'm going to read it to you, because we were dealing with the definition of terrorism. Is a campaign against people of color defined as terrorism? You know, it's a very interesting point. It's a very
interesting point. Yeah, sure. That's spreading hate, wanting to have an impact on a broader area, a broader population than simply the victims of the bombings or the attacks. And so it would fit, yeah.
And Anita says, is racism a form of mental illness? Well, I certainly think so. I certainly think it is.
Mental illness is another reason why someone might go out and kill people without any other apparent reason, anger or... We don't know what motivated the Las Vegas bomber. We don't really know what motivated the kid in Texas who put all the bombs around Austin. So mental illness could be any number of complicated issues that would cause that behavior. And it may not be terrorism. They may not have had a political motivation behind them.
Keith says, give us three female politicians in a room, and New York State would be much better off. The three men in a room isn't cutting it. And then says, the plastics rule that benefits Cuomo's donor is a good reason for me to vote for Nixon in the primary.
That's an excellent point. I've endorsed Cynthia Nixon. I think she's the change we need.
Christopher says, terrorism. I think the media and politicians abuse the word terrorism, and in my opinion, you should reserve it only for situations where you're sure it's terrorism. If the actor is affiliated with a militant group of some kind, or they clearly lay out their political motivations before the act or acts, you can be pretty sure. As far as Malcolm attacking the Pulse, I'm so sorry. As far as Mateen attacking the Pulse nightclub, I myself don't put a lot of stock in his spontaneous declaration of political purpose during the attack.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. The term we came up with was psychodrama. Mm-hmm. It may have been playing out there with a veneer of terrorism in order to justify his actions to his family. Huh. PhD thesis available for anybody who needs the right one.
So where will your PhD be through?
I don't know. I'm going to have to work on it.
You need an advisor? Mary says, Judith is right. There are reusable bags made from strong but lightweight synthetic materials that wad up almost as small as plastic bags and fit into your pocket or handbag. It's supposed to take about a month to develop a new habit, so you can be carrying them with you automatically till the end of April. And that's from Mary.
All right. Thank you, Mary.
Yeah. And Lynn says, Trump, greetings, panel, and morning and good morning. I am thinking that the leaders of North Korea, South Korea, China, and Japan are astute enough to size up Trump and cut him out of any discussions and determinations pertaining to their countries. They know he is volatile. Your thoughts, please, Lynn and Castleton. I think that's a very bad idea, Lynn. The fact of the matter is Guy is president of the United States, and if he commits to some kind of a detente or some kind of a workout of all this thing, you couldn't do it without him.
Well, I was very hopeful about this meeting with North Korea that's supposed to happen in May, and I was a little Pollyanna-ish about it, give peace a chance, etc. And then Bolton was nominated. So I think
who wants a preemptive strike on North Korea?
Yeah, right. So I think it's like 50-50 if the meeting's even going to happen.
This is going to happen with or without Trump.
Right.
China has now stepped up to be the adult in the room, and they are using diplomacy. And when this is done, when there's some giant rapprochement between the North and the South, North Korea is recognized as an international player and a nuclear power. Food and oil start flowing back in there for their little concessions. They won't disarm. Mm-hmm. The United States will be left off to the side, and the world will see that our power no longer matters.
So the train trip by Kim to China was what, Malcolm?
Oh, yeah. Kim Jong-un, like his father, went for his first trip outside of the country in his life. So he went by
what do you make of what it was
evil
about?
Evil villain super train.
The alternative to the Acela.
It was fully armored train.
Is that an Amtrak?
Yeah, sort of. Only it was on time.
And an unlimited amount of wine.
It was all business class. As you said, that trip was designed. China and North Korea are going to work this thing out now, and China will see themselves as essentially the preeminent superpower.
What took them so long? What took China so long, as you say, if they're the adult in the room?
You know, the funny thing is, a lot of people are saying we have to give Trump credit
for shaking this thing up. But when you're talking about the potential of nuclear war, it's less about that, and it was more about North Korea having a viable nuclear capability, and that forced us to now come to the table. There will be no disarming North Korea. They've joined the club, and now they're going to be recognized. Mm. And if we can just limit them from their bellicose rhetoric, they will benefit economically. China will see to that.
And yet we see that everybody's saying denuclearize North Korea, and you think that's not going to happen.
Oh, yeah, they're gonna denuclearize. Not.
Speaking of China, anybody terrified yet the Chinese space lab could plummet back to Earth as early as Saturday?
Yeah.
Authorities saying a fiery end to one of the country's highest-profile space projects, the 40-foot-long Heavenly Palace, which I believe I ate there a couple of weeks ago. It's delicious. Expected to fall between March 31st and April 1st, according to the European Space Agency. That's the question.
It could be somewhere over most of the United States, China, Africa, Southern Europe, Australia, or South America. Somewhere there.
Or
so
the
you
oceans.
So you were kidding before, Ray, when you said this morning that it was going to Great Barrington?
Yeah,
you
it was going to land on your little house by the pool. No, you know, this is going
it's
to be a
big one.
It's
the size of a house. Isn't that it? It's about the size of a house?
In reading further down, I guess we should not be quite so terrified. Apparently, these sort of things happen many times a year.
That's right.
But this one could be a nice show.
It's a Skylab-type situation where it'll break up.
It won't interfere with our holiday weekend.
Mm-hmm. I mean, one would hope. There's always that chance. It might be one in a trillion. The reentry latitude is expected to be within 43 degrees north and 43 degrees south of the equator. That's a pretty big swath stretching from New York to Cape Town. It's not possible to be more specific yet.
The world, right?
So are the odds.
Canada and Russia are not on the list of where it might fall. I just thought that
makes I still think it's hitting Great Barrington.
Okay, Ray, take it back before I start getting telephone calls.
All right, I'm kidding.
Mar-a-Lago jokes.
It's gonna hit Castles.
Okay, so my question then is, what are the chances relative to winning the Powerball lottery, which is now at an all-time high?
Your chances are better to win the Mega Millions.
The Mega Million.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
I think it's the other way around. The chances are better this falling on your house.
Really?
Okay.
Yeah,
listen.
Slightly.
By the way, that material is valuable. The pieces that come from satellites. There's a whole subculture. And if you're going to sell it, you sell it to the Chinese market.
Yeah.
Right? That
now,
you'd
be valuable for collectors or intelligence organizations?
Collectors. Nah, we don't want that piece of trash.
They say there's some toxic chemicals and such
then
in this one.
Then there's that part.
Yeah.
Of course there is.
Only about one-tenth of it will make it through the atmosphere,
yeah,
they
it'll
think.
Be a
well, it still could be a fair
mold.
Amount.
So it could be a small garage that will make it through.
You know, it'll be somewhere between tomorrow and April 1st, according to the most recent estimates. You know, the thickness of the atmosphere varies at different points.
You're right,
so the drag is different, and we're not sure yet.
I got to get me a truck.
Well, what I thought was interesting about the story is that the Chinese are not allowed into our space station, although the Russians and the U.S. and so many other countries are. So they're really developing their own space program. They're going to put up their own space station in the next year or so and build that out. And they've already sent people into space. So, you know, it's a lot like the 60s during the Cold War.
But it's not exactly a ringing endorsement of the Chinese space program. They put this thing up. They used it twice, and it's coming down.
You learn.
Indeed. Jeff Sessions said Thursday he won't immediately appoint a new special counsel to investigate a number of Republican grievances involving the FBI and Justice Department, despite mounting pressure from members of his own party. Sessions, in a letter to three Republican committee leaders, reiterated that he had directed a senior federal prosecutor, this is Utah U.S. Attorney John Huber, to evaluate certain issues. Huber's review is ongoing. Republican lawmakers have been calling for multiple special counsels. We only have a couple of minutes left. Who wants
to? Go ahead.
Well, first of all, you know why they're doing that. They want to divert from Mueller. That's a given. But secondly, Sessions himself is somewhere between a rock and a hard place, because if he doesn't do what they want and doesn't help them distract, then the president fires him or potentially fires him. And if he does, he's already eliminated himself from the whole Russian thing, because obviously he's a little bit afraid that they have something on him. We know that he didn't tell the truth.
Well, it was a conflict of interest. He needed to withdraw because he did not tell the truth, and he had meetings with Russians. But there's no conflict of interest now for Sessions to oversee that. There's no justification for a special counsel in this case. The Justice Department has the means to investigate this.
This is just fluff. This is literally them saying, we want you to use the power of the Justice Department to attack the investigators who are investigating the president.
Sure.
It would be the clean. I mean, if Sessions had even leaned in that direction, he could find himself under the special counsel's investigation. I mean, he could literally be charged with obstruction of justice.
All right, Judith, you're waving a piece of paper at me, and I'm dying to know what it is.
I am. I just want to remind people that on April 20th, there's going to be a really special roundtable presentation Page Hall.
Would that be Earth Day?
Right before Earth Day. It's on climate change. WAMC has lined up an incredible group
including
of writers.
You.
And Elizabeth Colbert and Terry Tempest Williams and Jeff Goodall. And everyone should go to the WAMC webpage. It's free and open to the public. Thank you, WAMC. But you do have to pre-register. It's at Page Hall at downtown SUNY Albany, 9 a.m. to 11. And we especially want to encourage teachers to bring their classes. It'll be a wonderful climate change discussion.
Are we broadcasting that live or is it a taped thing?
Yeah, no, it's going to be the program. That morning
with a live audience.
I don't recall us doing a broadcast from Page Hall since late 90s. Pete Seeger did a concert there, and I remember I had to engineer that thing. It was at Page Hall, and for the life of me, I cannot find the tape of that. We have it somewhere.
Maybe you can't find it because maybe it didn't happen.
What do you mean? It happened.
Oh, it happened?
Yeah, I was there.
Okay.
On April 20th.
Okay. You know what, Shartok? We got along this entire program without arguing with each other, and now you're irritating me. So let's end the show. I want to thank you all for being here. Malcolm Nance, what do you have going on this weekend?
Me?
Yeah.
I'm going to be going on my usual fare. In about 30 minutes, I'll be on MSNBC, and I've got Joanne Reed tomorrow. And then Easter, we're having an Easter.
We are so lucky
lunch.
To have you, Malcolm.
Nice. And Judah, how about you?
Nothing.
Nice. Mike?
I'm going down to the city tomorrow, but back for Easter.
Very nice. And how about you, sir?
I can't tell. Otherwise, I'd have to shoot you.
Please do. Hey, thanks for being here, everybody. And I hope you all have a great holiday weekend if you're celebrating. If not, have a fine secular weekend. It's the Roundtable on WAMC. We'll be back.